If you want to turn back to that passage, it's on page 89 in the Pew Bibles. I have a friend at Palmer's Green Church who really likes climbing mountains. He likes walking on the flat as well, but I think he particularly likes climbing mountains. I remember one conversation some years ago now where he told me that he'd climbed 124 Munro Peaks, and they are mountains in the UK which are 3,000 feet and above. He's probably been on one of those three peak weekends where you rush around climbing the three highest mountains, one in Wales, one in Scotland, and one in England. Strikes me as a bit busy. He did at one point have his ambition to walk up the last of the Munro Mountains when he was 60, but I have a feeling he might not quite make that. I've certainly been to the top of the mountains in Switzerland. The only mountain I've actually been right to the top of in the UK is Snowdon, and I cheated because I took the railway. At the tops of mountains in Switzerland, there are quite often Bible verses, because people have been there and they've seen something of God's creation. They are, of course, in most places in German, but fortunately I can read that. And so it's nice to actually see people appreciating God's creation. And in the Bible, there are lots of significant things that happen on the tops of mountains. We didn't read it this morning, but in Genesis chapter 22, there's the episode where God tests Abraham. And he tells Abraham to go and sacrifice his only son, Isaac. And they have to make a long trek, and they go up to the top of a mountain. And when God sees that Abraham is willing to obey him, he relents and provides a ram for the sacrifice. That's generally thought to have been on Mount Moriah. And that's also recognized as the site of the temple that was later built by Solomon. It's also somewhere in the vicinity of Calvary. And some people have in the past drawn that line through time, from the time where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac and God provided a replacement, to the time where God actually did sacrifice his only son as replacement for us and for our sins. Other significant events on mountains are, of course, the giving of the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, the battle with the prophets of Baal that Elijah undertook on Mount Carmel. In the New Testament, we have Jesus being tempted on a mountaintop. We have a sermon on a mountaintop. And they're all significant events. But somehow this particular one feels a bit different. There's something intriguing and special about the Mount of Transfiguration, with Jesus' clothes shining and with the appearance of people who had long departed the earth. It's by tradition celebrated both in the Eastern and the Western churches on a particular day. That's August the 6th. Quite why it appears in the lectionary as the reading for today, given that, is perhaps a little bit of a mystery. But the real question we have to ask ourselves if we're looking at the Bible is, what does it mean? But if we're to do that, then we perhaps first need to look a little bit and ask ourselves, what really happened? Or what's the significance of it? Now, we're never going to get a complete answer because we weren't there. We don't have CCTV at the event. But if we look at the parallel passages as well, particularly the parallel passage in Mark, we can see a number of things about the narrative. If you look back to chapter 8 and verse 27 of Mark, there's a specific place mentioned, and that's Caesarea Philippi. In Luke, it says about a week later. In Mark, it says 6 days later in verse 2 of chapter 9. Luke's account tells us when this happened. It happened when Jesus was praying. And we know that it was his habit to go apart to pray. If we look at where it occurs within Mark, it occurs after Jesus has begun to speak about his death and his suffering. And I think we can assume that all of these things confirm that however strange, supernatural an event it was a real event in Jesus' normal earthly life that these writers are describing. One of our essential doctrines in Christianity is about the person of Jesus. It's about the fact that he was both fully human and fully divine. That's something that I certainly cannot fully understand, and I don't suppose any of us can. But it's something that we believe. We don't know how it happens, how it worked, but we believe it. But of course, his divine identity when he was on earth was hidden, was veiled. As a line in the hymn that we'll sing in a few moments' time says, he came not to be served, but to serve. And what his three closest disciples here see is perhaps that veil being drawn back from his face, so they can see for a moment that he was fully God. And the writers describe that in a way that says his appearance changed and his clothes shine, an unearthly white, one presumes. But we also need to consider where he is. He's on the mountain. If it's, as many think, Mount Hermon, it's 9,200 feet high. And if they were anywhere near the top, there would have been permanent snow. And you can just imagine the effect of the shining of Jesus' clothes and the snow. But Jesus is there to pray, because he's just started to talk about suffering and death. The human part of him, at least, needs to be sure that his planned trip to Jerusalem is both necessary and the right thing to do, the right time to go. And I guess in a way he already knew the answer. And yet because he is fully human, he wants this confirmation from his Father at a critical point in his earthly life. And then we have the extraordinary appearance of Moses and Elijah to Jesus. There are no details given in Mark, of course, but in Luke we see that they are talking about his coming death in Jerusalem. And no doubt they are encouraging and supporting him. And if we think of their own lives, they are uniquely qualified to do so, because they both experienced a sense of isolation and a struggle with the leadership role into which they were put. Remember how Moses reacted when God appeared and told him he was to go and deliver the people of Israel. He really didn't want the job. He told God that he couldn't speak, but that excuse was taken away when his brother Aaron was given as his assistant. Elijah experienced crisis of faith when he's pursued by Queen Jezebel. But they're also significant in other ways as well. They uniquely represent the law and the prophets, because Moses is the man who receives the law. Elijah is the first and in some ways the greatest of the prophets. There's something unusual about the way in which both of them departed the earth. Moses, as is said, was buried by God. Elijah, as you probably remember, was taken up to heaven in a fiery chariot pulled by four horses of fire. Now, I wonder how you'd react if you saw this. You'd woken up after having some well-needed sleep on the top of a mountain and you see somebody with you whose clothes are shining in this way. They were understandably frightened. And of the three, well, we'd guess it would be Peter who would speak up first, wouldn't we? Even though it's recorded in Mark, he didn't know what to say, and in Luke, he didn't know what he was saying. But the words do indicate, perhaps, a real sense of wonder as well as of fear, a desire to capture that mountainside experience. And really, it's not necessarily whole days and periods that we remember the most. It is moments. I once had a poster that actually said that. We do not remember days, we remember moments. And I think that is largely true. But Peter's response also adds to the sense that this is a real event. For it's so ordinary, it is so Peter, so typical of his reaction. The other question we might ask ourselves is, why are the disciples allowed to see this event? I suppose the obvious answer is that if they hadn't seen it, it wouldn't have been written down for us, and therefore it must have a purpose. But it would also surely have been a moment for these three that they remembered for the rest of their lives, that they remembered when they were going through suffering and persecution, a moment that would give them courage and hope for the future. And then no sooner has Peter spoken than God himself appears in a cloud and speaks to all of them. There aren't many occasions, in fact, just three in the Gospels, when God speaks to those around Jesus, at his baptism, here, and in Jerusalem, and that's recorded in John chapter 12. Each time it's just a few words, confirming either directly or indirectly just who Jesus is. And by implication, God also confirms that Jesus is following the right path. He tells his disciples to listen to him. Then the moment's gone, and Jesus is alone with his disciples. Mark records that on the journey back down the mountain, Jesus specifically forbade them to tell anyone of that experience until after his death. And we see from Luke's account that they did not do so. The reason for that is surely that Jesus was all too aware of the popular conception of a Messiah, and an extraordinary tale like this would only boost that opinion. Popular views would be inflamed, and who knows what would happen. The disciples still have to learn that Jesus did not come as a conquering king, but as a suffering servant. But in the future, they will be able to tell others, and that's significant because no less than seven times up to this point in Mark's gospel, Jesus has forbidden people to tell of the events that have occurred. The disciples at this point, I think, do not understand what he means by rising from death, but they don't ask him about it. They do ask about Elijah, which is interesting, and Matthew, in his account of this passage, records that they probably did understand that the reference to Elijah that Jesus made was to John the Baptist. They're left to ponder the future suffering and rejection of the Son of Man. So having considered what might have happened, we have to consider what we might take away as being important. Why is this passage here? Well, we don't need to climb a mountain to pray, but we should certainly remember the importance of prayer. Significant things happened when Jesus prayed. And we need to remember prayer, especially when we take major decisions in our lives. If Jesus needed to take time apart, then surely we must also do so. And it may, in some ways, be more important in our modern world, particularly for us living in a busy city with so many options as to how to spend our time. I guess we're probably not going to hear God's voice in quite the same way as recorded in this passage. But God always hears us. He can assure us in the silence, or perhaps warn us by a feeling of uneasiness as to whether we're going the right way or not. God doesn't desire to micromanage us, I am sure. He doesn't desire to tell us what kind of colour wallpaper we should have. But when it comes to the big decisions, careers, where we live, how we spend our time, what we might do for the church, what we might do for others, I'm sure he wants to have a role and a say. Location and time for prayer don't matter in themselves, I'm sure. They should be those that work for us. For many, that may be in the morning. For others, it might be at night. Perhaps some find it better in the day, or perhaps all three, for surely we should be remembering God throughout our working days. But secondly, I think it also shows us something that we can look forward to. We can look forward to a day when God's glory is more fully revealed. There are moments when in someone around us, something that somebody does for us, or something that we see in God's creation, when we might feel that we have a glimpse of God himself. But one day, he will not be hidden from us. Although I like travelling up mountains, I've no great desire to climb them. But if you do get away from the crowds, it can be especially beautiful. One day, in a sense, we will live permanently in what we might describe as a mountainside experience. Or if our preference is for the beach, then a beach experience. If our preference is for museums, then we'll be like going round all the great museums. And then thirdly, they came down the mountain, didn't they? They didn't stay there. In the meantime, we do need to continue to live our lives fully on the ground. We need to live with the difficulties of living in a secular world. We also need to live with at least some unanswered questions, just as these disciples had to do. But we should nevertheless do so while maintaining our faith in God, the God who created us, the God who sees each bird that falls to the ground, the God whose angels count the hairs on our heads. And then fourthly and finally, we are to tell others what we've seen and experienced of God's love. There's no injunction on us not to tell. In fact, just the opposite. We live under Jesus' command to be his witnesses. That's not always an easy thing to do. It won't always have the results that we might wish, but it is his clear command. And although the Bible is freely available, many people these days simply do not read it. So we may be the only witness that some people have. So I think this morning we are encouraged to pray, encouraged to live our lives in having faith in God, encouraged to tell others. But we are also given this magnificent glimpse of how different things will one day be.